Hi, this is Jay Nimmer. You're listening to The Life Autistic. This is episode number 672. Let me go ahead and give you contact information. Contact information is, if you want to contact me for one reason or another, just remind me of something I've forgotten, try to give me some kind of better take on something, I'd love to hear from you. The email address is autism, A-U-T-I-S-M, at Quix, Q-U-I-X, .us. Anyway, so, the whole question of diagnosis, of things, of everything kind of around the whole idea of diagnosis, and whether it's useful or not. I'll tell you right up front that I find that diagnosis is of somewhat limited value. I think people stake way too much on diagnosis than it probably really deserves. Let me talk about where my attitude comes from and what colors my perspective. I am not a historian at all, but I do tend to try to think back and say, where did all this get started? What would have motivated things? And when it comes to diagnosis, it really has to do with matching up a condition with a treatment. And so you would give a name to something that you had seen that has common traits, common... come on, Jay. You know, that you can diagnose, and, you know, even from the Middle Ages there's been books about, okay, if you see this kind of rash in this sort of a place, under the arms or in the crotch or whatever, you know, we call it this, and the treatment is, you know, leeches or whatever, you know. And and that's where essentially the whole idea of diagnosis came from. Your doctor is primarily a diagnostician. He goes in, he tries to figure out what he thinks you have. And when he kind of nails down what he thinks you have, there is a prescribed treatment for it, whether it's a therapy or a drug or whatever. You know, that's what he... that's what he does. And that's what doctors do. Funny thing, you know, we pay them so much for this supposed expertise, but a reasonably intelligent person going through a decently well set up book or database or whatever could probably do just as fine a job of doctoring as the guy that gets paid, you know, seven figures. And I don't want to denigrate medicine. Who cares? That's great. I'm glad they found their little shtick. But I will tell you that I do somewhat denigrate all these people around the diagnosis and treatment of all kinds of things for some reasons that these things have been jimmied with and rigged with and made as inaccessible as possible so that people can be enriched off of it, and that this whole industry around diagnosis and treatment of ailments or disorders or syndromes or whatever, it's become a bit of a racket. There's too many people that profit too handsomely off of this. And as a result, you can't trust most of them because you can't think that they have their priorities straight. And if nothing else, for one pretty big reason, it's that it rarely has anything to do with the person who's got the problem, the condition that needs treatment. It's always about other people around them and how we're going to make their lives easier, or how we are going to enrich this group or that group that does it. you know, everybody always says, you know, oh, the first thing you should do if you have a child diagnosed with autism, the first thing they point you to is to a group that charges a membership fee. You know, you need to be a part of this organization. It can help you the most. It's like, they aren't really about helping particularly. Their biggest thing is about, we want to be the biggest group. You know, there's a certain political power to that. And the way you do that is you have a membership role, and the best way to keep a membership role, and of course to have a paid-for president and to have a board of directors and things like that, and to have people that actually get the work done, is you have to charge a fee. And all of a sudden, people, you know, it stops being about let's help people, and it starts being about we need to keep this organization running. You know, we have a research facility at this university that studies autism. It ceases to be about let's help people that have this thing cope with life or feel better or anything like that. It ends up being much more about, we need to keep our center open. We need to be doing stuff that brings in lots of money. Helping people feel good doesn't make money. Trying to come up with a pill or a therapy that is a financial success and that makes those who pay out money feel good, government / parents feel good, ends up being what's really important. You know, things get steered really quickly. And it's really easy for people who had normal, everyday, beautiful, wonderful lives and all of a sudden get their lives turned upside down because somebody says, oh, your kid's got this. It's really easy for them to get sucked into that because, you know, people go, oh, you need to be a part of the organization. Oh, you need to get a part of this foundation, that foundation. And you need to spend, and you need to put in time donating to the cause of finding the cure for this. Because, you know, and there is tons of money to be made, you know, keep ramping up hope that, oh, we're just so close to a cure now. For autism, it's really weird because it isn't even something that's easy to define. You know, multiple sclerosis, cystic fibrosis, these things are very well established. Been with us for hundreds and hundreds of years, and very, very, I mean, they can diagnose that down to the decimal point. Yes, you've got it. This is how long you've got to live with this. So this is what kind of a pain you'll feel. And the whole thing, it's kind of like with any kind of cancer. They can almost show you what your life's going to be like for the next 5 years, and that's if you're a survivor. You know, if you die, you know, often you die from, well, I can't say that. Anyway, you know, they can map out your thing. Of course, they try to do that with autism, too, but it's so weird and it's so different because it manifests itself, but it doesn't. That's why I came with Zenith. The Zenith are a whole different kind of people because autism has as much variation to it as normalcy does, you know? Well, there's normal people, and some of them really like strawberry ice cream. You know, we could think that that was weird and decide to call it, you know, strawberry ice cream fetish syndrome. But we've decided that we don't really see anything wrong with being like that, so that's okay, you know. And the people who like chocolate better, you know, they tend to go off to their own different little camps and stuff like that. And, you know, when their kids grow up, you know, the chocolate kids go to summer camp here and the strawberry kids go somewhere else. You know, and that's kind of a weird, I mean, that one's made up. It's a bad analogy, but when you start getting with autism, people get really frustrated with autism because they expect to be like, Down syndrome or cystic fibrosis or something like that where they can say, I want to know exactly what's going to happen. I want to know what the warning signs are. I want to know what I can do to make, you know, to set things right. And on a lot of those other things, you can certainly tell people a lot of things because they have so much in common. You know, very thing. You know, I compare it to, what if you had a pill that cured people of being normal? You know, it's like, oh, what do you mean? We don't want to cure being normal. And you go, sure you do. There's all kinds of attributes that people tend to fall into that make them bad. People tend to be greedy and selfish. People tend to be thoughtless of others. You know, they tend to be very self-centered. Things like that. Why aren't we working on cures for those behaviors that we don't like? Well, that's just, you know, that's just normal. You know, you can, with just working on it, not be like that. We can do cultural things to help stop that. And what I'm saying is, and I think the same thing is basically true with autism / Asperger's / ADHD / Zenith, whatever, you know, that you could be the same way about that too. Oh, I lost again. I had it and I lost it. I'll keep talking about it again. There was something I said I was going to be talking about around at the last podcast, and I thought about it here on this one. It just snapped back into my mind, and then I kind of wandered around with what I was doing and didn't ever come back. Sorry. Anyway, so when you get down to the whole idea of diagnoses, especially when it relates to something like autism or Asperger's, because what we're mostly talking about is a behavioral problem. We don't like how these people behave. And instead of setting up places or circumstances where they can behave the way they behave and it's okay, we've decided that it's much more important that they must fit in with normal people. NPs, neurotypicals, for instance. And so that's why we call it a syndrome and do this and do that, and you're supposed to, you know, and we come up with all kinds of therapies. We may even drug them to make these things happen. It's Rosebud Road. Does that go to Rosebud? Cool, because I've been to Rosebud. All right, sorry. I'm so sure it's still paved. I'm amazed. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. This is fantastic. I think I'm going to use this road more often because I like being off the beaten path. I really do. I like it a lot. Anyway, so when it comes to something that is a behaviorally based thing, you get diagnosed with autism based on your behavior, not on some, you know, you could call it a dysfunction, I suppose, but you know, it's mostly just on behavior. The word that gets batted around the most on DSM back when my son was diagnosed, it was DSM-3. Now it's DSM probably 4. The word that got batted around a lot was inappropriate. You know, they laugh inappropriately. They don't have appropriate eye contact. So one of the biggest sensations you get from the whole idea of being autistic is that it is a bundle of specific inappropriate behaviors. And that the biggest part of the treatment, quote-unquote treatment, or therapy for it, there's no, you know, and people say, oh, there's a cure, and you go, no, there's not. There's no cure for it. Is that you don't behave in inappropriate ways anymore. You either stop behaving ways that come naturally to you, or you have to replace what you do with certain other behaviors that are more appropriate. You know, the whole hand flapping thing. I think the hand flapping thing ends up, I think, for me being knee shaking. I shake my knee to deal with that kind of stuff, maybe. Because knee shaking, although they call that thing too, restless leg syndrome, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if most people with restless leg syndrome are actually Zenith people that just put other kinds of behavior into their leg because that was considered more appropriate than what they were doing, which was inappropriate. Flapping your hands around in front of your face. Ooh, that kind of feels, I'm sorry. Oh, wait, you can't do that because that's inappropriate. Was inappropriate, and we replaced it or got rid of it. Replaced with something that was more appropriate or got rid of it altogether. That's just, when you look at it, I don't want to say objectively particularly, but from a fresh perspective perhaps, you can almost say, well, that's just the stupidest thing at all. And you go, but yet there is an industry grown up around this whole idea of, well, we'll just make sure kids don't act that way. You know, they'll sit in their chairs like good little kids at school, and if they don't, we chastise them until they stop. You know, and so these are kids, these are people that have grown up with just enormous amounts of chastisement. And you kind of wonder why they have weird problems, and you go, hey, wouldn't you, in these circumstances, where everything that you do that makes you feel good, that kind of helps you cope with a very confusing world, if people say the most important thing is not to do that, you know? It was like my mother said just last night, when she deals with people who have delusions, she's a nurse. Apparently she doesn't have delusions. I don't know if I do. I try not. If I do, I tend to keep them quiet. I really, you know, that's one of the psychological tests you run for, like, life insurance, paramedics, what she does for money right now. You know, and she goes and she does these little paramedics. They're not too little. They're pretty important to the insurance companies. And you're supposed to talk about these things. And one of the most important things everybody just supposes must be true and must be done is that you must convince people to stop being delusional. It's an act of trying to bring them into the real world. And you know what? Honestly, I think that's a stupid thing to do. Why would you want to do that? The real world sucks. Have you ever noticed that? Now, I come from a cultural belief system. You can call it a religion if you like, I suppose, that says that we came from a better place before we were born, and after we die, we have the possibility of going to better places than where we are now. And so I come from a culture that says that this life, this existence, this reality that we live in is actually something of just kind of a test, as if you're being put into a room and sat down at a desk and put through kind of a test, not really sat down at a desk, but you go to the special place where there is a test. It's not reality. And based on how you do in that test, you helps determine your ultimate fate. You know, it's part of a process to see if you're worthy of something better. And that's what this life is for a guy like me. So when people say, oh, you need to come back to reality, honey, it's like, excuse me? This isn't even reality. Maybe autistic people have a better grip on, maybe they see outside of the testing area and they've realized that, you know, the things that need to be done here to qualify for a good thing aren't terribly important. Anyway, so hang on. Okay, I'm back, but I'm trying to remember now exactly what I was talking about. That diagnosis. We had talked about... all the money flying around when you do this. And I think I was getting to the point where I was talking about, you know, I personally have a... I don't trust very readily. And I'll mark it down as paranoid schizophrenia. Now, I think that a lot of paranoid schizophrenia is based on experience. People say, oh, well, yeah, but you're just taking that to an unhealthy level. The whole inappropriate thing, right? You know, everybody's a little bit paranoid, but you're taking it to a level that's inappropriate. And so we give you this thing and we, you know, lock you in padded cells. And I spend my time trying to avoid padded cells myself. And people say, oh, come on, Jay. You're not going to get thrown in a padded cell. And it's like, excuse me? Because if I really told people what I really thought, if I really expressed to people things that have come into my mind, things that I have perceived, things that I have seen and heard, you know, I don't think you'd feel so... so definite about the fact that, you know, I'm not going to get stuck in some padded cell. I may very well get stuck into a padded cell. Anyway, you know, and if you listen to this podcast, am I going to share everything? Yeah, maybe someday, but not today, and probably haven't yet, and there's a good chance that I might never get around to it, you know, because, frankly, I just want to survive. Okay, anyway, I'm kind of paranoid about things because I've seen what happens. I've seen that a lot of people that get into quote-unquote helper employment, you know, non-profit work, trying to help people. Now, I've met a lot of wonderful people, and I'm grateful for those wonderful people, but I've also met other people who were doing it for their own personal gratification, satisfaction, enrichment, whatever, you know, doing it for somewhat selfish reasons, and that they would do it on the backs of people who were, you know, who the money was ostensibly supposed to be for. You know, you can think of any given helping nonprofit organization and look at the person who's at the top of that organization and how much money they get, what kind of cool toys that they have. And you have to understand that their mindset, if they're that kind of a person, is all about, well, we want this organization to get larger, to get bigger. We want to get more government contracts. And they may very well say to everybody, and they may believe it themselves, it's all about our customers. It's all about, in the place I worked for, they were called the consumers. I think it's a sick term. I don't want to be a consumer, and I don't want to have to feel like I'm dealing with consumers. But that happened to be back in the 80s what was the current term to use that was supposed to be respectful. It doesn't sound respectful at all. You know, started calling them clients, and I was a little bit with that, but not much. It was all about the organization, and of course, when the organization prospered, people prospered. Those who were in charge of the organization, everybody got pay raises when things went up. You know, you were in charge of more and more things. You would hire more people to be under you, and you would find greater and greater amounts of success. And at some point, find yourself a whole different mindset, a whole different kind of person than you were when you started. That perhaps may have been, oh, I'm doing this because I love these people and I want them to have happy lives. And it ended up being, no, these people are tools to get what I need to accomplish now. You know, we need to sign up more and more people with disabilities, and we may even need to manufacture some of those disabilities, because the more people we have on our list, the more money the government or some other thing, instrument, will pay to have us handle things. And so, yeah, I'm not very trusting. So if people say, well, Jay, you know, you really don't have these problems. You aren't that kind of a person that you have a disability. And you go, well, you know what? Says, I sure seem to have the same kind of mindset they do. Of feeling like I'm just a pawn in a larger game. And so when people say, oh, Jay, you should go out and get diagnosed, think of all the benefits you'll get, the understanding you'll have. And you go, you know what? It has nothing to do with benefits or understanding. It may have a little bit to do with benefits. But by and large, there are benefits with so many strings attached that it loses a lot of its allure. And the understanding, oh, I'm sorry, that's probably the last thing anybody wants is for people with disabilities to gain understanding. People with understanding make lousy pawns, make lousy, shills. You know, people that kind of get taken advantage of. In the shill game, there's the guy that runs the shill game, and there's the shill. And pretty soon, when you have a disability, you find out that all you are is a shill. You're a way for certain groups of people, doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, non-profit organizations. You're their bread and butter. And you to have a happy life, a happy independent life, really kind of cuts into all those people's bottom line. And so, at some level, they lose interest in being a part of that, and they become more interested in either we need to get more people with this problem, or we need to make sure that these people that have this problem, you know, that they don't really get what they want. Happy, satisfied people don't need help. Don't need services. And that kind of works against the bottom line of the culture, of the industry. The industry needs new fresh blood all the time. Serving the same old people the same old way doesn't tend to bring in more money. There's no room for growth there. So anyway, so that's where that comes from. So when people were always getting interested, I happened to read a blog posting from one of these people. It happens to be the family I was talking about in the last podcast. They run a forum-ish bloggy thingy, and they had really gotten upset and angry and went to task trying to smear the name of Michael Savage, who does a radio show in the United States, pretty popular one, where he had denigrated the diagnosis of autism. And I frankly agree that, now I don't know if I agree with how he said it or anything like that, I don't know what his take is, but his basic idea, which is that this is kind of the diagnosis du jour now, and a ton of people get diagnosed as autistic, making it worthless because, you know, everybody and their dog is autistic. Just like 10 years ago, everybody and their dog had ADHD. Anytime a teacher had a kid that she didn't want to have to deal with or that she had problems working with, first thing you'd do is you'd take him in and you'd say, you need to go see your doctor. And everybody would start saying, oh, they've got ADHD. Let's put him on Ritalin. Sure made the school teacher's job a lot easier to have a bunch of kids on Ritalin because Ritalin kids don't cause problems. They're kids that are kind of, you know, well, I don't want to say that, But they are kids that are much more compliant and pliable. And schools love that. Schools want compliant, pliable kids. Ones that are easily influenced and that pretty much do whatever you tell them to do and don't buck the system, don't ask questions. Which, I'm sorry, I'm built that way. I'm built to be questioning and saying, I'm not sure that's true, or are you sure that you're not just being pandering? You know? Now, I don't want to say all teachers are like that, or all teachers that set their kids to get diagnosed with ADHD and to get medicated for it. You know, I'm sure they all said, oh, I was doing the best thing for that kid. And you go, you know what? You're getting sucked into the same thing. No, it really makes your life easier. And it also makes your job easier, and it makes you look better. You know, it may be more profitable for you career-wise. Yeah, I had a classroom full of ADHD kids. They go, oh, you're such a fantastic teacher. And those are pretty great strokes when all your kids were medicated down to the point to where you had to slap them on the cheek to get them to even go, what? You know, even to respond sometimes. Now that's an easy thing. I remember now what it was, and it has to do with what I'm talking about. It's called putting yourself in that person's shoes. And you have to be really careful with this. That tends to be an overused cliche, and it's been watered down. Let me give you a for instance. And at some point, hopefully, parents get to this point with children who have problems. Or adults try to, you know, and I'm not saying I'm some expert at being in other people's shoes. I think I'm built in that I can't be in most people's shoes for the very reason that I don't have feet shaped the same way as everybody else does in an allegorical sense. Since I'm a zenith, it's hard for me to put myself in other people's shoes. I have to work at it harder. It's more of a conscious effort for me. And I'm the first one to say that this is how I perceive your feeling, and it may be wrong. And half the time when I say that, people say, yeah, you've got it wrong. And it's like, okay, well, that's fine. Whatever. You know, whatever makes you happy. This is what it means. Let me mark that. Okay, so I come on, Jay. When parents first get that diagnosis, you know, it really is all about them. You know, their kid is this horrible, wretched creature. You know, you can even get down to getting kind of neat, you know, all touchy-feely about, oh, yes, I love my kid even though he makes my life a living hell. And you have to get past the whole my life is a living hell part first before you can start saying, now how do I think my kid is feeling? And then you have to get past that. Because it's really easy. You can almost see a progression that parents take as they start to get a realization of their circumstances, that this is permanent, that this isn't going to change. There's not going to be some miracle cure, and all of a sudden you're going to have this wonderful kid. Your child is going to mature, and they're going to grow up, and they're going to either start handling things, and you can help them in that process. That's why you don't hear a lot about adult autistics. They either, you know, get themselves killed, I guess, or they finally find a way to, a place to interface with the world. Most of these people eventually find ways, or they get dealt with in a more traditional way with a disability. Either they end up having just kind of a way of looking at life. I can't say that. You know, We used to put them into mental institutions. I guess you still basically could today, even though it's not appropriate. Is that word again, appropriate anymore? But the places still exist, you know, that you'll find autistic people either in the mental illness, mental hospital, the place with the barbed wire fence around it, where they've done something that was so inappropriate that they got thrown in jail for it. That's where part of those people go. And the other part, you know, find some way to interface with the world. They'll eventually get enough language that they can get by. Or their parents will just live with the reality that their sedan was the place my mom was talking about. Maybe I need to go see sedan. Anyway, you get to that point. Okay, I'm sorry, but I got off the track of kind of the different phases you get to. First, it's all about the parents, and it's all about the people around them, and how much not having a normal kid causes them to suffer. You know, the kind of lost things. And I can't relate to that, and I won't try. I won't tell you that I can, that I understand, because I don't. Because this is my life, you know. It's also buggered up by the fact that I'm probably autistic too. And I'm not going to sit and get all teary-eyed and weird about that kind of garbage particularly. You know, it's not interesting to me. Anyway, so I guess people go through that thing. And then they go through the thing of, I'm going to advocate for my child. My child cannot speak, cannot tell me how they feel, so I'm going to project what I think they should be feeling onto them. And that's what advocates do. If somebody treated me like that, I would start killing everybody. So they start projecting the fact that their child probably wants to kill everybody. That's where you get the kind of idea that my child is stuck inside of this shell and they really want to get out. That's the parent projecting themselves into their kids and saying, I'm sure that there is a perfectly normal, wonderful, beautiful, normal child inside this horrible body that is autistic. And we're just trying to reach in and touch that person, kind of like the picture of God touching Adam on the Sistine Chapel. Somehow we will make that connection. And all of a sudden we will see that this is just a normal kid trapped in a horrible body. Or in a horrible brain, sorry. Not a horrible body, horrible brain. And that is simply a normal person trying to project normalcy into an autistic kid. And that at some point you have to get past that too. And then it becomes, okay, you know, I'm going to really try to put myself in my kid's shoes and try to see things from their perspective, not try to say, well, I'm going to put myself in their shoes and I'm going to look through their eyes and my child's basically just like me and I'm going to fight hard to give them access corridor to the real world. And it's like, wait, you know what? Your kid doesn't want that real world. Your kid likes the world they've created. Well, they need to come into my world. And you go, but your world sucks. Your world, you know, from my cultural standpoint, this world is fake. It's as fake as you know, oh, I don't know. It's as fake as having a house facade that's made out of painted cardboard. It just looks good, and we all act like it's there, and it's real, and it's the most important thing, when it really isn't. And you go, maybe that kid has the right perspective. He knows this is fake, so he's creating his own world, knowing that the world, the regular world, isn't any more valid than the one he's creating in his head. Anyway, you know, the whole thing about why fight people's delusions. If their delusions are going to get them killed, that's one thing. If they're just delusions, and they can deal with it. It's kind of like the guy that had a beautiful mind, you know, that beautiful mind movie. I found it sick. I found that movie sickening. I found what society demanded that guy to do sickening. What he was doing was not hurting a soul. You know, certainly exercised his mind a whole lot. Well, it's not real. And you go, so what? So what? Was he getting ready to kill anybody? No. Everybody who is, well, I mean, I have to be careful because I'm very sure that I forget parts of the movie. And I'll have to say this from my own experience. Now, I don't know how that guy is. Sometimes I can't tell the difference between my perception of things and what other people would probably consider to be reality. And what I end up doing is I end up deferring all the time to other people's perception of reality, thinking, maybe in error, that their perception of it is more valid than mine is. You know, well, you're paranoid. And since you're paranoid, we can't listen to you because you're going to be wrong every time. There are no, you know, nobody gets locked up in mental institutions just based on what you've been telling us. And you go, excuse me, I've seen it. I've heard about it. I've heard news stories. And plus, it makes the powers that be very happy. Paranoid people tend to combat the fact that this is inappropriate or the fact that being too paranoid can get you killed or can get you sent locked up somewhere. They tend to put up a false front. I'm not going to say I'm a master at it, but I do it. I have done it. Over time, I have tried to stop, but honestly, it's just a whole lot easier in this world to be false, to be, to lie about your true feelings about anything. Because when you do that, okay, at 11 miles from the place that I ticked off, that is now empty. There is another place that is now empty. It used to have signs out. It looked like it was at least doing something. Now it's abandoned. I like looking at abandoned places because I like looking for places that might be better place for me to live than where I live now. I wish they were a little bit more off the beaten path, but honestly, what can you do? You know, you can't get too weird about these things. Anyway, so, well, I guess you can. But what I'm saying is, maybe it might be more damaging to you personally to do it. So we do all these defensive things to try to save us from these things. That's one of the many reasons why I don't get diagnosed as autistic. Because I'm afraid that what I've spent so much time building up trying to take care of my family, trying to be what I consider to be a responsible member of society, trying to get ahead, trying to take care, you know, not even a responsible member of society, but just for the freedoms that I have now, I'm afraid that if I get diagnosed that I'll lose some of those. Because all of a sudden, there's certain things that will become closed to me. And when I put up a facade, more things, I tend to have more freedom. So I tend to go for that more freedom, even at great personal cost to what I really am, to the point to where I don't know what I am. You know, what I am has more to do with other people's perception of me than it has to do with being really honest about how I am and how I would prefer to be. That becomes worthless. It's much more important how other people think about me, because other people are what pay me money that supports my family. Other people's perceptions of me make all these things happen. I would like to have a place that's further away from reality, from, you know, being in the thick of things, for the simple reason that then maybe I can let my hair down a little bit. And I think it'd be good, I think it's a good thing to be a little more authentic. And I find that really difficult, because I have to spend so much of my time not being authentic. You know, this isn't the real Jay, but I will never show you the real Jay. You know, there's things I don't show to my wife because it hurts her. You know, the fact that I'm not as emotional as I probably should be, and that I create a lot of the emotions that come to her naturally, I manufacture them so that she can feel like that she has a normal husband. And she knows she doesn't, but the closer I can get to it makes her happier. So I do that. We live in the house in the... Well, no, I can't say that. We don't live in the house she would like to live in. She would like to live in a much larger, much more well cared for, much more well appointed circumstance than she does now. So she doesn't have what she wants either. And I certainly don't have what I would consider to be what I want. And but when the decisions come based on all the criteria, how much money we have, stuff like that, she tends to get more of what she wants than I do. You know, I worry, because if I were to become successful, for instance, if I were to write this book, and this book would all of a sudden be really successful, and I would have millions of dollars at my disposal to use as I wished, I think that would destroy our relationship, because I think I would tend to give my wife what she wanted from that, which I think is a little more opulent of a lifestyle, and I would be wanting to buy with that a large piece of land in order to escape, and that's not what she wants to do. She kind of, I think, humors me. Only because she knows that she will always win, you know, that these things will never happen because she doesn't want them to happen, and that her vision will ultimately win out, and mine will just never be really seriously considered. Anyway, so when you put yourself into somebody else's shoes and you try to say, I really want to know what would make them happy and try to help them get to it, I think that's when it really comes down to parents saying, you know what, I'm not going to fight with the school system to try to get them services. Because honestly, do those services make my kid happy? And you go, I don't know. You really have to come down to either saying, I don't know, or saying, well, I'm going to go for it, or, you know, I'm too tired, and my son seems to be happy. My 16-year-old son, Matt, is basically a pretty happy guy. He's got life the way he would like to have it. Things that we strive for all of our lives and never really get, Matt has right now. He is what I call free on board, which means, you know, his life is taken care of for him. The fact that he might not be satisfied, you know, he can't express it. And it's really hard to try to figure out what he really wants. He seems happy, so we're just going to go with the fact that he seems happy. When he gets upset and angry and starts talking about that, or if he's upset and angry for a long time, then we start exploring how do we make Matt's situation better for him. I think right now Matt would really like to have a video DVD player hookup thing. Lisa doesn't want him to have that because then she'll never see him. And it's like, well, Lee, let's start to think about what's really, you know, it really becomes a battle between what's in Matt's best interest, quote unquote, Matt's best interest, and what is really what Matt wants. And when you get right down to it, it starts being about, well, you know what? Who defines what the best interest is? And, you know, and what ultimately does that really have to do with Matt and how he feels? And you start to find out that it really has very little to do with how he feels, which is where this came from. The whole diagnosis idea came from that there's some better state that everybody wants to get to, but when you deal with autistic slash Venus people, that all gets muddied because it's like, well, what does the autistic person really want? And nobody considers that particularly. Hopefully, luckily, I think fortunately, parents get tired of trying to push society's vision on their kids because they're just too tired of the fight of doing it, and they let their kids do whatever they want, and then autistic people finally get a few things that they want. And I guess what I'm saying in a way is that since I'm married to a normal person, and this is a normal person's reality, this is a normal world, and therefore, normal people should, you know, it goes the way normal people want it to go. And I don't have a problem with making, with letting that be honest, you know, with that being the reality. I just know that this isn't my world. And that, and that it's not for me, you know, and that it's not designed to meet my needs, it's designed to meet other people's needs, and I need to just deal with that. Now, I have hope that at some point in the future, perhaps after I'm dead, or perhaps after my wife dies or passes away, that that I can start working on what the things that I've needed, maybe, or wanted, or whatever. And, you know, and I worry that I'm just simply lost. You know, that even given my cultural take on that this isn't reality, that this life isn't reality, that reality is something in the future, that I won't, you know, that I'm going to be pushed into some circumstance that doesn't really suit me very well there either. I'm perfectly prepared that that might be so. And that I better just get used to it. That everything in reality is created for other people, and that it's not for me at all. And that, you know, what's my purpose here? Well, it's to make Lisa happy, you know. And it's looking like that future afterwards is also going to be about making Lisa happy, and that my happiness is immaterial. That what makes me happy, and I'm going back to that diagnostic term, is honestly simply inappropriate, and therefore is of no value, and that I need to just let that go too. You know, that happiness is nothing for me. That my life is full of responsibility to other people and making sure other people have nice lives, and that it has nothing to do with me. And it sounds kind of sad, but you know what? Hey, it's my life. I could have chosen to go in a different direction. I could choose to be more selfish. But let's not do that. Let's not do that. Anyway, this is Jane Emerald. Kind of a, I don't really like the soul-searching ones because it really indicates that even though I may have a soul, it's not mine. It's not mine. You know, I'm supposed to spend it on others. And that's okay. I need to be okay with that. Sometimes I'm okay. A lot of times I'm not, but, you know, get used to it, buddy. That's the way the Zenith Life is. Jay Nebro, you're listening to, what episode is this? Episode number 672, Diagnosis. Big one. I apologize. If you want to contact me, if you feel like that you've met your kindred spirit, the only thing I can say is, I'm really sorry. Your life must really suck. And I feel for you. If you feel like me, then, you know, if you're suicidal, I don't blame you. If you're, you know, if you just don't want to be around other people, I don't blame you that way either. You know. Anyway, so feel free to contact me. This is Jay Nemro. The contact information is autism, AUTISM, at nmsu.edu. No, it's not. That's my, oh my gosh. I'm sorry, that's my work one. That one's wrong. It's autism at, that's not really my work one either. Autism at Quix, Q-U-I-X, .us. The first time I've ever had a big change over that way. Horrible. Oh my gosh, what happened to theater here? Looks like somebody just destroyed it. Just beat the heck out of it. Oh my gosh. Oh, no. They're playing a movie tonight. Hancock! Maybe I'll come into town and watch the movie. Anyway, this is Jane Emerald. You're listening to The Life Autistic. Autism at Quix.us. Episode number 672. Have a great day.